This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays. I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today my special guest is Steve Jones, who was formerly on the faculty of Brigham Young University and who served as co-chair of Scholars for 9/11 Truth until quite recently, when on 5 December he resigned as a member of Scholars over differences between him and me with regard to the politics and the science of 9/11 research. Today we're going to emphasize the science, but the politics and the science are inextricably intertwined here. And today I think I have to just clear up a couple of issues related to the politics before we turn to the science, because Fred Burks, who proclaims himself to be a trustee of the domain names for Scholars, has sent out a list of 55 key 9/11 figures, or so he claims, where he gives gross misrepresentations of my views about the science in an attempt to undermine my position with regard to Scholars, including the claim that Fetzer began publicly promoting theories that energy beams directed from the WTC-7 brought down the towers. It is true I've advanced such an hypothesis, but I haven't, you know, I've promoted it in the sense of wanting to invite attention to it because I think it deserves exploration, that the towers fell faster than possible according to physics. Well, my position is if the government's account, where in the 9/11 Commission report, for example, the South Tower came down in 10 seconds, since a grand piano, for example, falling from the building would take 12 to 13, that is faster than free fall through air if the buildings came down 10 seconds. So that's a perfectly correct claim, but here it's edited. And then he says, most infamously, that a grand piano would take three times as long as a billiard ball to fly from the height, contradicting the findings of Galileo and the Tower of Pisa. Well, this was a considerable misrepresentation. On one occasion, perhaps twice, in Tucson, I talked about a special case of a grand piano coming down, say, where it was falling with its lid open, functioning like a parachute. Now, it's no contradiction of the laws of Galileo that objects can fall slower than free fall. Galileo's establishing the rate at which they fall when they're solely acting under the influence of gravity. For example, if you had a grand piano that was attached to a helium balloon, or a grand piano that actually had a parachute. I was talking about a case where it was functioning as though it were a parachute. Now, this is a special case, and I agree that it's misleading if you want to make that kind of point, because it is a special case. On the other hand, in science, in order to explain everything, we have to take into account every factor that makes a difference to the outcome. These are supposed to be reasons that are discrediting to me. He says these claims were even made in prominent links direct from the homepage of the group's website. Well, I had links when I had Judy Wood on. I had links to her website, and those were on the homepage when she was appearing on my last broadcast on Republic Broadcast. And certainly there was a link to or two to my Tucson lectures, some clips, but this was hardly a big deal. I mean, it's peculiar because this is from a guy who has taken control of our domain's website. He has frozen the website. He's conducted illegitimate votes. He's now changed the website. And as far as, you know, being in an embarrassing position, he's a fellow who has been a translator for presidents and who claims to have translated messages from aliens and believes that extraterrestrials are guiding the transformation of the human species. That's, of course, a very interesting question theoretically. It's very akin to von Doniggin's theory that aliens visited Earth to populate and possibly populate the Earth as a colony. Possibly that's a view of Fred Burks. I would not know. But if ETs were transforming, you know, overseeing the transformation of human species, who was overseeing the transformation of the ETs? Earlier ETs, other ETs? If you don't have evolution going along at some chain, you get a regressive explanation that doesn't explain anything. In addition, he gives a false depiction of the relationship between Steve and me, and one reason I want to mention this is so Steve will have the opportunity to correct anything I say if it is at variance with his recollections. He says, I unilaterally fired Jones from his co-chair position, proclaiming that his sole founder and major force of the group, I alone, had the right to determine what happened with the society. Well, Steve knows that I removed him as co-chair because of his role as the moderator of the forum, when, in my opinion, very inappropriately, Rick Siegel was cut off from posting criticism. My view is you got to accept criticism publicly or privately. He was trying to do it privately, and that it was inappropriate. And I asked Steve to, explain to me why I should not take him out, which he did not do. So I did remove him as co-chair, but later when he decided on his own to resign, I encouraged him not to do it. I said, why don't you take 48 hours more to contemplate this? And as far as, you know, acting unilaterally, well, there are only two of us, Steve and I, who even had the authority to remove a member for efforts that were undermining the objectives of the society. So only he or I could do this, and certainly as the founder, only I could possibly remove him as co-chair, so that's highly misleading. He also suggests that I'm threatening Alex Flom, who originally obtained the domain names and who refused to turn them over to me, with a lawsuit, which is completely false. The only two alternatives I've considered are filing an ethics complaint against Alex for appropriating them to himself domain names that were obtained at my direction on behalf of the society, which is a violation of the lawyer's code of ethics, and also pursuing a domain resolution through this international society, ICANN, which I am doing. He says here, Fred Burks, that it could mean the loss of support could cost his job and the means of support for his wife and two young girls, but that's got to be absurd. I mean, anyone could bring a suit against anyone or an ethics complaint, and surely just by doing so couldn't possibly lead to the loss of their job or support for their family. I mean, otherwise people would do it all the time and lawyers would be out of business, since lawyers tend to tick a lot of people off. Finally, he says, the members just recently voted by an overwhelming 6-to-1 ratio for a joint homepage, which he's now installed, ignoring the fact that 68% didn't participate in the vote at all. In addition, he says that they have covered all costs associated with these domain names. When domain names are extremely inexpensive, they run about $8 or $10 a piece. And as a matter of fact, the domain names here appear to be freebies that were given because it's a special kind of arrangement with this organization, One and One, where you get a free one when you have one. And when I call them and talk to them about the situation now to try to make sure that Fred Burks was renewing the registration for the domain, they told me that they thought that he had, but that it was a special kind of deal and that these were freebies. So all this is very strange. And this guy sends this out. He says that I'm the one who's being divisive, and he's the one who's trying to be a uniter. I mean, he used to be a translator for George W. Bush. Maybe it all rubbed off, because remember, Bush came in claiming he was the uniter, not the divider, and we've never had a more polarized country. This guy appears to be, in my opinion, trying to bring this research in 9/11 to a grinding halt. He signs off by saying, deeply committed to what's best for all of us and to personal and global transformation through love and empowerment. And I say, well, that's quite a remarkable statement from a Fred Burks, who, in my opinion, has been the most divisive force ever encountered here in relation to Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Now, having said all that, Steve will have the opportunity to clarify anything I've said that he thinks is mistaken, but we're going to focus on the science of 9/11 today, and I just had to get that off my chest because Fred Burks has just sent out this message today, and it seems to me to be so full of distortions and misrepresentations that I wouldn't want anyone to be taken in. Those who may be interested in the history of these disagreements and their political manifestation should visit 911scholars.org, the website that I've created as an alternative to st911.org, given that Fred has frozen the site, and study the articles under the Founders Corner to review the history. I'll be right back with my special guest, Steve Jones, Jim Fetzer. This is the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host of the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays and Fridays. Today, my special guest is Steve Jones, and as I welcome him to the show, I want to add to my previous remarks that Steve has informed me that he advised against freezing the website. And for all I know, he may even have opposed this letter that Fred Burks has sent out, because yesterday I notified him of what Fred was planning to send, him and Carl Weiss, and Carl had sent me a copy of a request of Fred that he not send it. So I'll allow Steve to address that for himself. But regardless of the politics, Steve, I want to welcome you on to the Dynamic Duo and look forward to addressing scientific issues related to 9/11 research.
Right. Yeah, I do want to get to the science, of course, Jim, as we talked about. That's, I think, where we can unite our efforts. On this other, who did you say Fred sent that letter out to?
He sent it out to 55 key 9/11 researchers, or leaders, as he put it.
Well, I didn't get a copy of it, so you're telling me about this. Now, so I guess that kind of indicates something, but in any case, I really can't comment on it since he didn't send me a copy of it.
Okay,
and I haven't seen it.
I'm sure you agree with my description about how our relationship, you know, developed during early December.
Well, I have some comments, you know, the moderator issue. That moderator who took that action was anonymous, but I did agree that his action was appropriate, as we discussed among the moderators, so.
Yeah. Well, listen, Steve, I have now watched your lecture from Berkeley, as you had asked me to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I have looked at a lot of other issues here, and there's a whole lot for us to discuss. And typically, of course, you begin by talking about the nature of science and scientific method, and needless to say, we would agree that science is our most reliable method for determining what's true and what's false. So a tremendous amount of authority derives from science. Now, the question I want to ask just as an opener, and this is a very general and for the benefit of our audience, is how do we know who the scientists are? I mean, the field, after all, could be infested with quacks or charlatans. I mean, like, take medicine, for example, or the law. We've all heard stories about, you know, persons who hung out a shingle. So think of a guy who's, you know, maybe obsessed with sex and puts out a shingle to the OBGYN, and it may take years before they catch up with him. How do we know who are the scientists?
Well, of course, in the modern, since Newton, really, as these steps were developed, as there's this transition from the Dark Ages, and the scientific method was a large part of that transition, the Renaissance, of course. Now, what was worked on the days of Newton was that scientists would publish in peer-reviewed journals, and this is really how we identify, in one way at least. You may have others, but from my experience, which I've published about 50 peer-reviewed publications, including Nature, the major UK Journal on Science. Three times I've published in Nature, one of which was an invited paper in 1986. I've published in Scientific American. That was peer-reviewed. And, of course, Physical Review Letters, first author on a couple papers there, and other publications. So
let me agree completely with that, Steve, that peer review is an appropriate part of science. But on the other hand, in any other field, like among historians or sociologists or psychologists, they publish in their professional journals. Their articles are subjected to peer review. And it's not, of course, distinctive to the physical sciences.
Sure, of course. So I think that's the key.
What I'm really trying to get at is the following. I mean, you know, you talk about, you have a conception of scientific method. Wouldn't you agree that the scientists are those who follow or adhere to the principles that define scientific method, and that that's what makes them distinctive?
Well, that's certainly part. It reminds me of a discussion of, but no, I think publication in peer-reviewed journals is a very important part to set this apart.
Yeah, but you
it reminds me of a discussion
I had done the research to get there before you put it into the form of a finished research report for submission to a journal. So,
absolutely.
I mean, we both have a lot of experience. I mean, I founded and edited an international journal, Minds and Machines, for 11 years. Previously, I had spent 10 years on the co-editing Synthes, a famous journal in philosophy of science, theory of knowledge, and scientific methodology. We both have a lot of experience here. But I'm just trying to get at the nature of science itself, because a lot of people who call themselves scientists. We have library science, we have mortuary science, we have military science, and just because somebody calls himself a scientist, that doesn't make them a scientist.
Well, no, but of course I think that the publication in the peer-reviewed journal following application of the scientific method is what I would, an interesting question, but is how I would define a scientist. Now look, Jim, in my letter A, this is the first letter in the Journal of 9/11studies.com. It's just one word, Journal of 9/11studies.com. I did add an appendix here just in the last few days to show, this is from University of California at Riverside. And in there's a flow diagram describing the scientific method. I just went ahead and provided the link, and then I quoted out of that for convenience of the reader.
Well, you know, interestingly, I mean, while you're a physicist, I'm a philosopher of science, right? I have a PhD in the history and philosophy of science. I've published 150 articles and reviews, probably 60, 70 in peer-reviewed journals and all this stuff, Steve, and numerous books, okay? I probably have a half a dozen books or more that deal with philosophy of science or the theoretical foundations of computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive sciences, emerging disciplines to assess their scientific standing. Now, I haven't looked at this flowchart, but I can tell you the characteristics of scientific inquiry, because, I mean, that's the field I study. So, some people, like Alex Flom, have expressed surprise that there could be somebody who knows a lot about science if they're not a scientist in a specific field. But it's analogous to directors and critics in relation to actors. Actors may or may not know as much about acting as directors and critics, but there's certainly room for argument as to who knows more. And with regard to having a specific area of expertise, I mean, I would suggest those of us who spend our time, you know, studying the history of science and the philosophy of science as our profession, may, you know, actually be in the position to assess the adequacy of scientific work in a multitude of fields, which is what I've been doing for the last 35 years. Yeah, we'll be right back with my special guest, Steve Jones. We're discussing the nature of science and the science in relation to 9/11. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here usually Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. I'm sorry to say that the station has notified me that they've lost contact with Steve Jones. They're trying to reestablish contact, but he is not answering his phone. This is acutely disappointing. I very much hope that we'll be able to reestablish contact. In the meanwhile, I will address what I take to be some of the core issues that I'd hope to discuss with Steve about science and the application of scientific method to the investigation of the events of 9/11. One of the first points Steve makes in his lectures, of course, is to define the scientific method. And he offers the following principles to define scientific method: gather observations, evidence, make hypothesis to explain, experiment to test the hypothesis, data, refine or reject hypothesis, more experiments, publish in peer-reviewed venues, repeat the above cycle, others joining in, to generate a theory or a model of reality. Now, there's a lot to be said for Steve's characterization, but if one were to be, you know, exact, I think that it can't withstand critical scrutiny in several respects. Now, part of this is rather subtle. For example, when it said gather observations, he offered the illustration of observing the Twin Towers come down. And certainly that's an interesting special case. But if the function of, you know, if science is supposed to begin simply with observations, then we could observe anything. I've got a very interesting carpet, kind of a very tough kind of carpet, for example, on my downstairs basement. I could start observing all the little features of the carpet. I could go outside and start, you know, looking at the blades of grass if it weren't covered with snow. The famous example of the eccentric millionaire who, you know, wrote down all of his observations for his whole life every time a fly buzzed by or he heard a siren in the background or whatnot. And when the time came after his death to bestow this precious legacy, his attorney was disappointed when the Smithsonian Institute declined. But of course, you see, just observations, uncontrolled by hypotheses, can be completely scientifically insignificant. Now, the point I'm making is there's a subtle difference between an observation like the Twin Towers coming down and innumerable other observations we might make that aren't perplexing or puzzling or interesting. The reason why the Twin Towers, observation of the Twin Towers is important from a scientific point of view is because in relation to our background knowledge and our theories about how the world is put together, it's an oddity. It creates a puzzle, a problem to be solved to try to understand it, so that a more adequate conception of the starting point of science, and this could be said to be a subtle difference between observation, is puzzlement. It's an observation that leads to puzzlement, not just any willy-nilly observation one might make, 100,000 times during the day. So I think puzzlement is the right place to start. So this second stage appears to be, in relation to puzzlement, inventorying the full range of alternative possible explanations. Here I think there's a significant shortcoming of Steve's characterization when he says make hypothesis to explain, because he's focusing on one hypothesis alone. I sometimes have offered the example of murder cases, which we are also familiar with, where the detectives find a body, and perhaps there's some bruise marks around the neck. And, of course, the hypotheses might be that the person could have been killed by being stabbed, by being shot, by being strangled, whatnot. And here, of course, the way in which science is going to proceed is by figuring what's the probability of the evidence if the hypothesis were true. What's the probability of being shot if there are no bullet holes in the body, for example? Well, obviously, the probability of being shot if there are no bullet holes is zero. What's the probability of having been stabbed if there are no stab wounds? Well, if you had been stabbed, there would be stab wounds. No stab wounds, and the probability, actually, technically, the likelihood, the amount of support provided to the hypothesis by the evidence is again zero. Now, if you have some strangulation marks on the body, that of course is suggestive, because if someone were strangled, they would have strangulation marks with a high degree of probability. So that's suggestive of conferring a high degree of probability. That puts us in the domain of what's known as a preferable hypothesis. But notice it's a matter of comparing hypotheses. We have to consider all the different possible causes that might have brought about a given effect. In this case, the death of the decedent. And figure out if those hypotheses were true, what is the probability of the effects that are observed? Based upon preliminary data, it could be the case that the strangulation hypothesis, it confers the highest probability on the evidence and therefore is the preferable hypothesis among the alternative set. But when we send the body off to the medical examiner and they conduct an autopsy, it may turn out, lo and behold, that while there were bruise marks on the neck, indicative perhaps of a physical struggle, actually it might turn out the party had been poisoned by a barbiturate suppository. Now, that's not something that would be obvious initially, but it could turn out, as we gather additional evidence, that we would be able to sort out and discover that that was the actual cause. So conducting experiments and gathering more evidence is, of course, always appropriate, and that's the third stage of science as I would characterize it, the first being puzzlement, the second, speculation, the third, adaptation, where we figure out the relationship between the hypotheses and the evidence using likelihood measures to determine which is the preferable hypothesis. So the hypothesis, which if true would confer the highest probability on the evidence, has the highest likelihood. And then as the evidence settles down, when we reach the point that the evidence settles down, that it all more or less points in the same direction, and if you have contrary evidence that you're able to explain it. And contrary evidence in this case might be, for example, an alibi. But if the alibi turns out to be fabricated or faked, then you see it no longer stands as an impediment to drawing an inference, because all the evidence points in the same direction. I would say, Steve talks about, refine or reject hypothesis, more experiments, publish in peer review venues, but there's no elaboration here, articulation of the principles of reasoning, which are likelihood principles related to probabilities that are fundamental. And so I think that, we need to have a greater clarification about the nature of scientific reasoning, and that it's very much in the area of probabilities and likelihoods rather than conclusive evidence that constitutes the basis for verification and falsification. Verification is demonstrating conclusively something to be true. Falsification, demonstrating conclusively something to be false. The most elementary cases might be, if you want to claim all rabbits are white, the production of a single brown rabbit falsifies the hypothesis all rabbits are white, because it's not possible for that generalization to be true if there's even one brown rabbit. On the other hand, the verification is just a matter of establishing that something is true, typically on the basis of observational evidence. So if you observe a brown rabbit, there is at least one brown rabbit. That's something you have verified. Now, sometimes evidence and hypothesis is such that it's capable of both verification and falsification. For example, the hypothesis that you have 10 coins in your pocket. that could be verified or falsified, because we can go through all the evidence exhaustively. But very often we can't go through all the evidence exhaustively. The evidence is only partial, it's only incomplete, and therefore we have to try to figure out what happened without being able to conclusively establish, without being able to verify it or falsify it. So if there are alternative hypotheses about what happened at the World Trade Center, what may have caused their destruction, it's not a question of verification or falsification, it's a question of testability. Can we gather evidence that tends to weigh upon the probability or the likelihood that those were the means that were used in this case? This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays. And I'm delighted to say we've reestablished contact with Stephen Jones. Steve, I was just talking about, you know, scientific method and the model you offer. And, of course, you know, it would be surprising that as a professional philosopher of science, I might have some reservations about the model. It wouldn't mean that work you had done wasn't independent of the model, because like this distinction between observation and puzzlement, that's a subtle business that in practice may not make a great deal of difference. I do think your focus here on single hypotheses is consequential, because the only way we can show one alternative is the preferable or the best explanation is by comparing it with the alternatives.
Am I on at all?
Yeah, you are, Steve. Yeah.
Okay, because I heard most of that, and of course, I agree with the multiple hypothesis. I do that, and I talk about that in my letter A, which is published and in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. It's already published on multiple hypotheses. I don't know.
Yeah, that's good. I'm just talking about your characterization here of the scientific method, C. I mean, it's just...
It's in there, too.
Yeah,
have you read my letter A?
Clarifying it because of certain... But these could be viewed as, you know, philosophical differences.
Look, it's fair for me to ask him.
An interesting case that comes to mind, Steve, that you talk about in your lecture.
Can you just answer one question, Jim? Did you read my letter A in the journal?
I read your letter A, Steve. I may even have printed it out here.
You know, once you read it, you'll see that we're in agreement on the method. But I'd like to get to the explanatum that you talked about, the basic data, and not talk about strangulation and white rabbits and so on. That's fine for...
illustrate logical
points. Focus. Sure, I understand that. I'd like to ask that we focus on basic data. Time's getting away from us.
Well, don't worry, Shape. We're in okay shape. I just want to make a point. You can talk about Luis Alvarez, you know? Luis Alvarez is an interesting case. I mean, here's a Nobel Prize winner, right? I mean, a guy everyone admires as a scientist. Interestingly, I was struck when you brought him up because I'd encountered his work in relation to JFK. You probably would not know. But Luis Alvarez introduced an argument about the whole movie of the assassination, a so-called jiggle analysis that was supposed to establish that there had been only three shots based upon the reaction of a man taking a home movie to the sounds or vibration from the gunshots. And when we replicated his work, and I'm sure you agree that replication is an extremely important part of science, we discovered that Luis Alvarez had been very selective. He'd picked and chosen among the evidence and only cited three when in fact there were multiple indications of these kinds of jiggles. In an article by David W. Mantic, now appears in the book I edited called The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, which addresses it and explains, you know, what was going on here. And the point I'm making, Steve, is that, you know, the science is self-correcting. Even a man of the noted stature of a Luis Alvarez, it can turn out that he has made mistakes inadvertently or deliberately in his research. It can be exposed by replication. Now, if we come thermite, there's a very interesting question I want to raise to you about
Jim,
a letter you wrote on published on 8 December. Where you were talking about, I was promoting on the website notions that energy beams from WT7 or from space knock the towers down, and that you've repeatedly asked me to view the video of your talk at the University of California, which provides the latest physical evidence for thermite use, reinforcing the data in my published paper. Now, the question I have for you, Steve, this is a logical point. If thermite was used, does that mean that, for example, directed energy weapon might not have been used?
What you have to do is first start with what needs to be explained, Jim, the data, the basic data regarding the destruction of the buildings.
Yes.
That I think we have to agree on. Then you look at the multiple. No, I don't think we do, and I think that's the fundamental problem here.
Well,
is that we need to establish what are the data that we're working with, the the basic database.
Yeah.
Then, then you look at various
hypotheses. Philosophically, it's known as the explanandum in terms
Absolutely.
Of the totality of what it is
I agree
trying to
with
explain.
You. That's what I'm talking about. I'd like to focus on that first because that is where that's what we test our hypotheses against, right? So
well,
I'd like to focus on that.
In terms of their explanatory power with regard to the explanandum, absolutely right.
So let's start with the
explanandum. Have you looked at... The full range of photographs, for example, with regard to the destruction of the World Trade Center as a totality, some of the stuff, for example, that Judy and Morgan have emphasized on their website.
Sure, but
if
now
you go to
my point number 11 one.
Scholars right now, there's a nice piece, a video that gives a survey of it. It was a high-tech weapon from the Star Wars program used on 9/11.
Yeah, I've read through that. And in fact, as I made, excuse me, my voice a little iffy with cold out here. But as I went through and wrote down 15 points of basic data regarding the destruction of the World Trade Center,
yes.
Then I pulled out of that paper. I referred to that, my paper, James Gourley's paper, Frank Leggy's papers, and I'd like to... See, we talked about getting out a letter, Jim, between the two of us where we could publish something. And I would like to suggest that we start with the basic data, the explanandum, as you call it.
Well, I mean, what I'm talking about, Steve, is that the use of thermite or thermate is not exclusive with regard to alternative mechanisms.
That's not,
you know,
that's
whole,
not basic
range,
data, though.
That's... You're suggesting that you talk about in your first letter, right? So, mini nukes or directed energy or HARP or solar energy. Actually, you've done research of your own on some of those. I know, for example, your solar cooker research.
Well, on the radiation, that's one of the basic data points. That's my number three, actually. I have measured or looked for induced radioactivity in World Trade Center steel and dust. And as I report in that letter A in the Journal of 911 Studies, the radiation is not there. That is, all I get is background levels from the World Trade Center steel.
Now,
and I explain
now,
in some detail.
That would be... very important if all modes of mini nukes or nuclear energy would produce radiation of a measurable,
right.
detectable kind.
Right,
I mean,
right.
I take it there are whole families of nuclear weapons, and some are very sophisticated and have low radiation yield.
Well, of course, but they all, if you're using, as I explained in that paper in some detail, any nuclear weapon produces neutrons copiously, and these neutrons will induce radioactivity in materials. And I've used that trick for measuring what's in materials, the induced radioactivity. So you look for that. It's a very standard thing. And I talk about some of the sand that was from a nuclear test back in the 1940s, actually, and it's still radioactive. I used the same instrument on the World Trade Center dust and on steel from the World Trade Center, and no radioactivity, you see. So this is a critical point. There's more. And this is just one of the items of data. We have tritium, just a few nanocuries per liter. And again, tritium is essential in the hydrogen bomb, which most of these mini nuke folks talk about. So that's just point number one, the basic data there. And you could say, well, now we compare that with theory, and that's fine. But I would like to say, let's establish the basic data first. And because I really don't think we're on the same page.
Well, I quite agree.
On all these
as I look at the basic data, it's this massive amount of devastation. It includes these huge, like, scooped out gouges in Building 6 and Building 5, the huge gash in Building 3.
Right.
I'm having a very difficult time imagining how thermite could have been responsible for those.
Well, let's establish the data first, and then, but yeah, there's explosions that apparently, in particular Building 6, I think, is quite clear there's a big explosion that would cause that to
but
Jim, you're getting ahead of it.
Begging the question, I mean, it might have been an explosion, but mightn't it have been some other source?
I mean, certainly it might have.
It's almost surgical, Steve. You know,
look,
I've drawn
we agree on the data.
Kidney in 1983, and of course, when my kidney was taken out, there was this huge gap in my side. Well, it's like the you know, a section of that building had just been surgically removed. It's quite stunning.
Sure. And so we agree on the data. There's a big hole there. Now, let's go to point number one, which I have here, if I may. World Trade Center 7 fell in 6.5 plus or minus 0.2 seconds.
Hey, I think we agree completely on Building 7, Steve. It was a classic controlled demolition.
Nearly straight down,
into its own footprint, i.e. its own basement. You know, it has a little kink at the top. It came down virtually the same speed as free fall through, air.
We've done
one
of
three. Agreement on building seven, I'm happy to say.
Now,
there's a step forward.
We'll be right back
with my special guest, Steve Jones, discussing the science of 9/11. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays and Fridays. Today with my special guest, Stephen Jones, former co-chair of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And Steve and I are talking about the explanandum, or what it is that we want to explain in relation to the events in New York on 9/11. And I've mentioned that on 911scholars.org, you can find, if you scroll down halfway down the page, a nice video under the heading, "Was a High-Tech Weapon from the Star Wars Program Used on 9/11?" A very nice video compilation that runs about 5 minutes and a half. And if you go further down into the article section, you'll find the website that has been created by Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds. It's incomplete, but it has a lot of valuable stuff under the heading of the Star Wars Beam Weapon Hypothesis. And Steve, I think page three is a good page that offers a summary of an awful lot of the evidence or the data or the explanandum we want to explain. And I just wonder if you have a chance to go to that page. If we scroll down, you know, we might see, I mean, some stunning photographs like the buildings turning to dust and so forth. I mean, it's just staggering
to
me.
Let me
ask you this question and turn the mic over to you. Is it your position that it thermite on the Twin Towers, if those were used to bring down the Twin Towers, that can also explain the damage to WTC 3 and 4 and 5 and 6?
I'd like to start with the explanandum. As you said, of course, I believe that super thermite could indeed, yes, because it's explosive, as you know, or at least I hope you know.
We have
1994 data of people then working with the super thermite, which is the ultrafine form of thermite. It's a variant that is highly explosive, and in fact it has a higher energy density than conventional monomolecular explosives like RDX and HMX. So that's one thing to be explained, sure, and it's easily explained by use of super thermite. But I would like to focus,
Steve, I have incorporated... If you brought down the Twin Towers using this, say, even super thermite, that would cause the damage to WTC 3, 4, 5, and 6 that we observed?
Excuse me, no, I mentioned super thermite could have been placed in these other buildings. And I'm looking in particular at WTC 5 and 6. I think it's very likely that explosives were placed in these buildings as well.
Well, you know, not to bait the question, but wouldn't we want to look at what alternative possible causes could have brought about those effects? You know, to me,
absolutely.
Looking at 6 with this gouge out of it and looking at 3 with this gash in it, I mean, I just don't see where thermite plays a role there.
I've explained to you, but first we start with the explanandum. What all the data that needs to be explained, not just the hole in Building 6, which is very interesting, could have been by an explosion, of course. For instance, in my list of data, basic data regarding the destruction of the buildings, all of them, we have a published paper now. We have to deal with that because it's peer-reviewed and published by Jonathan Barnett et al., which talks about high-temperature corrosive sulfidation of World Trade Center steel. This is both from the towers and from Building 7, you see. Now, the sulfur, which is involved in sulfidation at high temperatures of this steel, where does that come from? Now, you can look at different hypotheses, sure, and you say, okay, this is established now, the data. We can't just ignore it. And rather than saying, well, let's look how the thermite hypothesis, which easily explains
today,
that.
This is part and parcel of the theory that the aluminum cladding on the external in interaction with the steel caused the buildings to weaken so they were actually fragile?
No, it's not part and parcel. According to Barnett and Eager and Greening, what they say is the steel sitting at high temperature, about 1,000 centigrade, in these molten or high-temperature pools, after which they don't really explain, but just sitting there in wallboard, which is gypsum, which is calcium sulfate, there's your sulfur. They say that can explain the sulfidation in the steel, you see.
Right. That's, this is trying to explain away your evidence for thermite.
Yeah. So how do we test their hypothesis now? They say, okay, but they don't state it as a hypothesis, you know, between you and me, Jim. They're saying, this can explain it, therefore we're done. But as scientists, we're not satisfied just saying, well, if you dip hot steel in crushed wallboard, it'll sulfide. What? How do we find out? I mean, this is fairly obvious, but as a question, how do we, as you'd pose to them, how do you find out? How do you establish that as a fact?
See, well, this is terribly interesting. And
you do it as an experiment.
Today, I was reading this very piece you're referring to.
The answer is an experiment, right?
Yes.
Absolutely,
the fact of the matter is,
Steve,
I'm willing to grant that thermite were probably used or may very well have been used to bring down part of the building. But if they're used to bring down part of the building, that doesn't mean they're used to bring down all of the building. And in fact, the seismic data and the fact that the bathtub wasn't made non-functional to allow the Hudson River water to flood the path train tunnels and the subways and all that indicates to me that the bathtub can't possibly have been hit with a mass equivalent to the 500,000 tons of those buildings.
Okay,
fact,
basic data again
just,
on the bathtub.
We just posted an article today, Steve, that's really fascinating about how Building 6 was brought down, was pulled using cables. And it was pulled using cables, the remnants, because they were afraid they were going to damage the walls to the bathtub. Now, if it's that fragile that they had to take that rather modest building and pull it down with cables very gently to make sure they didn't damage the bathtub, then there can't be anything remotely approximating the mass of those huge buildings that actually hit the bathtub. Most of that mass has to have been pulverized. Now, maybe that's part of your theory, too, that, say, 80% or 90% of those buildings were completely pulverized using thermite, and that we got those tremendous clouds of dust that envelop all of lower Manhattan that is really all that's left of most of those buildings. I mean, people don't realize when you hear the hypothesis of steel turning to dust, that's a requirement even of your theory, as I understand it. I mean, this massive dust cloud is really the departicularization of these buildings.
Jim, you've talked about two things, and again, we disagree on the basic data here. That's where we have to get back to the basic data before we can start speculating about which hypothesis. Okay, number one is the bathtubs. Number two is the pulverization, so-called. We'll talk about the bathtubs first, perhaps. If you read the actual reports, you find George Tamero. This is in a report. This is in James Gurley's paper in the Journal of 911 Studies. And so you can get the complete references there. I recommend you read it. He says, roughly 40% of the bathtub's reinforced concrete diaphragm slabs and steel columns are in pretty good shape. Now, only 40% are even in pretty good shape. What does that say about the other 60%, you see? So what we're saying is, let's look at the damage that was actually done to the bathtubs, the World Trade
Center. Yeah, but Steve, I'm making the point that its functional integrity was not compromised. It didn't allow
the water to flood the
basement area.
Actually, you see, here's another article talking about the train system. They had these huge tunnels, 16-foot, 6-inch diameter, were flooded for 40 days. Yeah, there's a point there you, I think, you missed. Here's another one. The force of the collapse, quoting, from this article on the damage to the bathtub, the force of the collapse destroyed much of the underground support system that held the bathtub walls in place, risking a massive underground collapse. To maintain the basement's relative stability, the engineers had to reconfigure the tieback system. So, and you can read, they drilled, they brought tieback cables, they brought in pumps. They didn't say whether they used them or not, but they did bring in pumps.
Well, I'd like to see some evidence
point
of this, Steve, other than words
on paper.
Well,
these are published reports.
Chief,
okay.
You know that.
Ah, see, this is the point, Jim. We got to get back to the basic data, agreeing that there was significant damage to that bathtub. Significant damage.
Because if they come down and hit that bathtub, there would have been flooding of all the subways.
There was flooding, as I mentioned. That's reported.
You couldn't just get that water out of those pathane tunnels under the Hudson River in a couple of months. I mean, it would be a huge project. We'll be right back with my special guest, Steve Jones. We're talking about the science of 9/11 on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetcher, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can hear the boy wonder on Mondays and Fridays. Today with my special guest, Steve Jones. Steve, I want to draw on your expertise as a physicist to help me understand the causal mechanism you posit, because I've never been really clear on, thermite as a cutter that cuts through steel like a hot knife through butter, and thermite even as an explosive that could do this pulverization. Are you suggesting both were used in the Twin Towers?
I'm suggesting that's possible along with other explosives. But again, Jim, the pulverization. I'm not sure we agree on the basic data there. And I have studied the literature. And I quote in my letter A in the Journal of 911 Studies, which I recommend you read, about the pulverization. I'd like to refer to that because if we can't agree on the basic data, there's no way we can sort out which hypothesis is
better. Well, I'm sitting here looking at it, you know, on page 3 of the Star Wars beam.
No, you need to look at my letter A.
No, I'm looking at the pulverization and the dustification and all this stuff, Steve. I mean, that's the basic data, including, you know, that the
it isn't basic
the bathtub
data,
was still functional, that we had these huge holes and gash in WTC-3, huge holes in 6 and 5.
Look, we're talking about
the
pulverization, okay?
The building disappeared in something
focus
like 10
on
seconds
about
free fall.
Time,
you grant up to 14 seconds, but it's still right in the free fall range if
we
take a grand piano 12 to 13 seconds to hit the ground falling through air alone.
Look, let's not talk about grand pianos. Let's talk about the pulverization for a minute, okay?
Go for it.
We raise that. Okay. So my question to you is, I'm pretty sure you haven't read my letter A. You said that. But if you will, please read it. You'll find in there a discussion of the pulverization.
Well, why don't you give us a
And there's a published paper on the dust. This is in, I have it up, Environmental Science and Technology by Paul Lioi et al. And they go through, they provide a table of the size of the dust. It is not powderized. I mean, that is, of course, a rather leading term. It's not ultra-fine. It's not even fine. Here's what they say. And they have data, which I put in the paper. I quoted their published peer-reviewed paper, and here's what they say. The environmental science community has been slow to understand, that the particles in greatest abundance in the dust were the unregulated supercores, not the fine or coarse particles that are typically measured. And then there's a table that shows that. In fact, what they show, when you look at this, 98% of the dust is the super coarse, and only 2% is less than 2 microns.
I don't know what to make of that, Steve. Because,
I do.
You know,
I do. It means
this,
that it means it's not being blasted to kingdom come.
Star Wars beam weapon website,
well,
and it's just covered with what looks to me like really fine dust, and you got this
you
staggering
see?
Quantity of dust surrounding and enveloping all of Lower Manhattan. I mean,
see,
that's,
Jim,
that's what's left of
that's
those buildings.
That's not quantitative. I'm talking, these guys have made quantitative measurements, and I have too. So I took the McKinley dust, which, by the way, it was provided by Jeanette McKinley from her apartment as the windows broke during the collapse of building South Tower. Yeah. And I looked at her dust. I measured it now, looking at the size of this dust and the powder. I used a 1.3 millimeter sieve, so we're just getting the larger stuff separated out. And then the smaller stuff than that.
And the reason that it's larger dust than smaller dust for the most part is it makes a difference because...
Well, because this is fundamental data. We don't have dustification. We don't have ultrafine
powder.
Well, we
have desks and furniture and computers and human beings and other living things turned to particles, Steve.
I'm sorry,
you know,
there
the
are.
First responders, they
see, again, we don't agree on that basic data.
Because they couldn't even find parts of a body. What the hell's going on?
They sure did find parts of a body. I've seen photos, a bone, a thigh bone. I've seen, they talk about, Judy talks about a filing cabinet, intact.
Oh, not intact, Steve. There's a little twisted kind of remnant that
but it wasn't dustified.
It's really strange.
It wasn't dustified. Jim, basic data now. They've measured, they've published, it's super coarse. I will put this in a paper, and it is
super
coarse. It's not
fine. We're talking
about
real tiny particles anyway. I mean,
it
you've
makes
got thousands
a huge
of
difference.
First responders, Steve, who are dying because they got this stuff in their lungs.
Of
I mean,
course.
How coarse can it be?
Most of it is coarse. The small stuff does have mercury and asbestos, yes. And I've measured now the mercury. I know how much there is in there. And it's interesting. There's a lot more zinc than mercury, which is part of this thermite.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Fundamental data, Jim.
My understanding
we have
is
to
no
agree on before we can make any progress.
Make
whatsoever.
I mean, this isn't inconsistent with you know your hypothesis. It's just that, to my understanding, it's not been done before. Is that right?
What hasn't been done? What hasn't
the
been observed
of
is
buildings
that
using thermite. I don't mean cleaning up a site. I'm saying actually demolishing
demolition
building.
Of buildings using thermite has been, as you pose it, has been done a number of times. You see. This is now called thermite arson, and there are a number of buildings that have been destroyed, and it has been proven that thermite was used bring down, to demolish, as
well,
you point out.
Well, something struck me, you know, about what I would interpret to be your proof of concept is your thermite grenade, you know, on the car, and it burns through, and I was timing it, watching it, and it took 10 seconds. I mean, that took about as much time for that thermite grenade to go through that engine block as it took for the totality of the south or north towers to come down.
Excuse me, Jim, you haven't obviously read Robert Moore's paper in the Journal of 911 Studies that talks about... That talks about slicing through I-beams now with the thermite device in a fraction of a second. And,
well, and but that still leaves the building come down under gravitational attraction, right? So, I mean, you know, you're not going to defy, we aren't going to defy Galileo that way.
No, excuse me, Jim. If you measure buildings that are brought down with explosives, including RDX, HMX, they could use super thermite. There are various, there's hundreds of variations you could use. You will, and time it, as I have done, actually making measurements, you will find that buildings brought down with explosives fall at nearly free fall speed, just like...
Oh, sure, Steve. I'm just talking about that it had to be the case that they were brought down using explosives or that they were destroyed. You know, let me ask you this. You know, Judy's offered what I think is this wonderful metaphor that these buildings are being pulverized, that they're it's like you had two gigantic trees and they're turning to dust from the top down. Do you agree with that?
You know, we have to be quantitative. We have to define what you mean by pulverized. It looks like controlled demolition to me with explosives, and that would include... And then we look for the residue, Jim. We look for the residue so we can nail them, right? I mean, you can say, well, it looks to me like it came down by explosives, but until you have residue or some proof to lead to a criminal trial, an action, that's what we're after.
We're not after some scientific discussion.
We're after action.
You know,
we want
if you could
efficient data.
Asking about
allow
the
us to proceed to a trial or investigation.
I mean, these are photographs of the dustification of these buildings, let me put it that way.
They don't dustify. I just told you that. The data don't support that statement.
Hey, we'll be right back with my special guest, Steve Jones. Stand by. This is Jim Fetcher, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Steve Jones, and we're discussing scientific issues related to 9/11. Steve, I'd like to ask your comments on the half a paragraph written by, I think, your favorite author. It reads as follows. Those who wish to preserve fundamental physical laws as inviolate may wish to take a closer look at the collapse of the South Tower. We observe that approximately 30 upper floors began to rotate as a block to the south and east. They began to topple over as favored by the law of increasing entropy. The torque due to gravity on this block was enormous, as was its angular momentum. But then, and I'm still puzzling over this, block turned mostly to powder in midair. How can we understand this strange behavior without explosives, or I would add, some alternative source, enormous source of energy? And that, of course, Steve, is from your own essay.
A long time ago.
The collapse of the towers, published in 9/11 and American Empire.
Yeah, and certainly it turns to powder. The point being, though, that it's a coarse powder. 98% of it is what is defined by Lioia, and they give the data published. 98% is super coarse.
I hadn't read the dustification because it's coarse powder?
Well, I think it's important to quantify this statement. I've heard ultrafine being flipped around, dustification, powderization. It gives the wrong impression. Yeah. It's time for the community to get quantitative, Jim, and to get data and to agree on published data and studies that actually measure these things. For instance, you mentioned the spire. So that I would like to talk about, the spire that appears.
The spire, you mean when the North Tower comes down? The dustification of the spire?
It looks like it dustifies. See, that's your term again. But in fact, if you look at another, Alex, in fact, brought up another video clip, and... if you look at that, what happens is this spire, as it stands there for a few seconds, it is certainly covered with dust. Everything else is covered with dust, and it does shake. And there's a piece of it that starts to bend over in the other clip. You can see because it's a close-up. And then what happens, Jim? Let me finish. You're cutting me off. That's not nice, man. Give me a chance to finish here, please.
That used to be building.
Okay, so here's the spire. Standing there for several seconds, and what you see is it shakes, and there's dust that forms, and then the metal starts to move. The metal portion here of this tower that was standing starts to fall. It doesn't dustify, Jim. What happens is it shakes, and this is what I observe.
Steve, have you looked into these
and the death weapons now
that are part of
the
full spectrum dominant Star Wars development project. Have you looked into any of these high-tech weapons?
Well, I've just read about them. I've not been involved in any of that.
Well, I mean, how can you rule out an hypothesis if you've never studied it?
I'm not ruling it out, Jim. I'm trying
to
establish basic data.
That you want to claim that thermite did it. Well, maybe the directed energy weapon could have done it better and is more consistent with the evidence in its totality than your hypothesis.
But the explanandum has to cover the sulfidation, which I have not seen the Star Wars method even approach to explain. But we do. And it has to explain the flowing metal, the orange glowing metal that falls from windows of the South Tower.
I've got to tell you, that flowing metal thing really puzzles me, Steve. It's like
a couple other
photographs that you sometimes use where these guys are peering in down below.
It was supposed to be the molten
metal underneath.
That's
if those guys were actually peering in that hole and were molten metal, it would be melting the skin off their faces.
No, we're talking about the flowing orange glowing metal.
I know we're talking about two different things. I'm talking about two photographs.
Yes, you brought up something entirely different, which confuses the issue. But let's stick with one at a time, please. I'll be glad to address them both. The metal that flows from the windows of the South Tower just minutes before its collapse, enormous amounts of it, numerous photos, a few videos are available. NIST probably has more. I wish they would release those, as you know.
Steve, do you know anything
wispy
about
white ash drifting away? It's not just
beaming technology developed in the Star Wars program where you got microwave generated plasmoids that can be used to destroy things. It was part of the attempt to develop an anti-missile system, and they found they couldn't hit a missile with a missile, but they created these plasmoids that have tremendous destructive power. I was called just today by coincidence by a woman who'd heard my talk at the National Press Club to say that there's a book entitled Decoding the Message of the Pulsars by a fellow named Paul A. La Violette, which has a chapter on this called Force Field Beaming Technology. And it just seems to me that this is something that has to be explored. Now, the subtitle of this is something about communication from outer space, but because of your affiliation with Fred Birx, I know that's not going to bother you, that this guy might be exploring the possibility of communication from...
That's not fair.
Well...
Just because I like the man and associate with him doesn't mean I agree with all his philosophies. No, that's not fair. But so, tell me, how does what you just described explain the orange glowing metal that flows from the South Tower and the wispy white ash being drifting away and the sulfidation? These are published data.
I'm willing to concede that thermite may have been used, say, to bring down the last 20 floors of the two buildings, so you have something left.
Jim,
my suspicion is
the flowing metal was from the 80th floor.
Looked like fingers going up into the sky. I mean, it's very weird. I just don't imagine. Do you really seriously contend that thermite can explain all this? And we're talking about basic data.
That's what we're trying to talk about. And I point out that the orange flowing metal came from the 80th floor, not the lower part that you were just talking about. So you see,
the photograph, that film, that piece of film looks very strange to me.
Which one now?
The flowing metal.
There's several films
out of the building. It looks really strange to me.
There's several films, and there's photographs, and it's discussed in the NIST report, and they talk about pressure pulses associated with these. With this flowing metal, and they also have a white reaction region, which they show, with white dust coming away from it. They don't explain that, but at least they're honest enough to present the data
to explain why the patient died. I mean, you got this huge phenomenon that we have to account for, and coming out of there, and I'm willing to leave that to persons more expert than I. For example, I think Judy Wood is the person I'd like to have engaged you in a conversation with over that flowing metal, but I'm looking at the totality of the damage and devastation is just stunning. Go to page 3 and look at figure 40A or 40B. I mean, are you seriously contending that thermite can have created this catastrophe?
Jim, I'm not limiting it just to those. I'm saying there are other explosives. But first, we have to establish the basic data. How do you get sulfidation of the steel in building 7 as well, not just the towers, but there, and also the flowing metal. Does Judy's explanation cover Building 7? Let me ask you that.
No, it's not intended to, because Building 7 was brought down by conventional demolition. I don't doubt that, Steve.
Yes,
and see, I'm willing to grant that you have established some use of thermite for part of the building, but just because it was used to part of the building doesn't show it was used for all. And I cannot envision how you could claim that thermite. Look, the patent on the thermite, as I understand, is only for 2 inches of steel. We know it's 4 inches at the base. I mean, how much of this stuff was scattered in these buildings? There were thousands of these things that would have to be cut by thermite to have the effect you're talking about.
Cut is right, but you don't have to just use thermite, as I said, over and over. And it's in my published paper.
You use
other explosives for the 4-inch steel dump. Why don't you never let me answer your question? I can do it instead of interrupting me after I half answer. That's not nice.
Pardon me?
Why don't you let me answer the question?
Please,
I was in the middle of a sentence and you start jabbering again.
Go ahead,
I think if you ask a question, you should let the person answer the question.
Steve, I'm just, there's so many questions I have for you, I just can't resist asking them. Go ahead.
Okay. At the base where you talk about the 4-inch steel, there you could certainly use RDX. Why not? Or you could use super thermite in the sol gel, which has higher energy density than the monomolecular explosives like RDX and HMX. Why not? There's nothing to prevent you from doing that.
Hey,
you don't have to limit it to just thermite and thermite.
Steve Jones discussing the science of 9/11. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays, Fridays, and occasionally subbing for me. My special guest today, Steve Jones, formerly my co-chair of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, now a member of a new organization called Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. Their website is stj911.org. Steve, may I ask, are there any links to the explanandum to all these photographs and videos and all that show the massiveness of the destruction from stj911.org to, say, you know, Judy and Morgan's website?
You know, I don't know, Jim. I'm not responsible for that. I'm a member of that group, as you mentioned, but I'm not responsible. I frankly haven't been to their website and explored. I have been there, but I mean, I haven't explored it. I will say though, Jim, in answer to your
indispensability of looking at the destruction in its totality, what it is we have to explain. So, I mean, I think
of course
we're absolutely
in agreement there.
But it includes, you know, the spectacular effects like the blasting of steel beams. I mean, hundreds of feet away, big sections of the building being blown off like javelins into buildings across the street and all that.
Sure.
Do you
it's
believe?
A good point that. That, you know, most of the towers, of the towers material did not fall on the footprint. It was blown away. And this of course, would be an indication of use of explosives and, of course, gravitational potential energy. Now, to say that that material was destroyed, however, that's another statement which does not fit into the explanandum. In other words, there's no substantiation for that material being destroyed. It's just blown out.
To the exclusion of others. I mean, some massive source of energy, but it doesn't have to be. Explosives tends to carry the connotation of something more conventional like RDX and so forth.
No, super thermite is an explosive. It's used routinely now.
Yeah, it can be another source of energy, Steve, that brought this destruction about. It doesn't have to be a conventional one. And it seems to me that you really have not been looking at the unconventional sources
in your research.
Of course, I've looked at the most adequate alternative explanation. You have to consider the other alternatives and show it's more adequate.
Look, Jim, let me answer. I did look at it. You can't tell me I didn't, because, by George, I did. Now, that's just rude of you to say a statement that is unfounded and not true.
I looked at it earlier. I told you earlier that you hadn't looked at the plasma technology, for example, or directed energy weapons, Steve. I'm taking you at your word.
Furthermore, the Gourley paper treats it in some detail. It's in the Journal of 911 Studies. And if you read that, and I'm inviting Judy and Morgan to respond to that. It's a good paper. They can respond a letter. It doesn't have to be peer-reviewed. They can just publish their response to Gourley's paper.
So you're maintaining that you have, in fact, in the course of your research, not only excluded mini-nukes, but directed energy, HARP, solar energy, plasma, weapons, and all that?
No, I didn't say that. I have excluded mini-nukes, and I've published a paper on that.
Okay.
James Gourley has excluded the other. I'm still looking at it. But I'll tell you what, if it can't explain the sulfidation, which is published, and the coarseness, the super coarse nature of this dust, and the flowing orange glowing metal that comes out of the South Tower, 80th floor right up there, see? And the wispy white ash that drifts away.
Well,
and
it's an incomplete hypothesis, right? That film footage, which I find very puzzling, is authentic. I mean, let's assume that.
let's talk about one other point, and that is the fact that the towers, as you look at it, this has to be in the Explanandum, do not collapse from the tippy top down. No. They start near where the planes went in. Huh? So that means that this beam, wherever it came from, has to skip the tippy top. Now,
Steve,
that means
just
that, to me, it means it can't come from space.
Author.
Please answer that.
He talked about that 34 is turning over and then turning to powder, and he's astounded by it. How does he explain it?
Look, Jim, I've told you. First of all, the data show what we mean by powder is mostly 98% supercoarse. And I've measured it myself, and I agree with those measurements that are published now by Lioi et al.
Well, let me just ask you, Steve, what
would
it have taken, you know, to implant these devices? How many devices would have been required for your thermite-thermate hypothesis to be correct?
Well, you know, I do have an estimate. It's published in my paper. It's in Journal of 911 Studies. It's also in
book. What is it?
It would take around, as I remember correctly, that's why we publish these things, is about 1,000 pounds.
Well, see, that's you get back to your 10 trips. I mean, I thought I was being quite faithful to what you had told me before, and I kept thinking about it and thinking, well, Steve must have meant a larger number. So sometimes I've said 10 min 40 trips or 40 min 10 trips because I think...
Why did you say that? It's in my paper. If you're quoting me, you should see refer to what's in my paper.
Well, I'm quoting you from having you on and talking to you and hearing you and all these good things, Steve. 10 min 10 trips, you never said that?
I didn't say it then, but you said you quoted 10 min 40 trips. Why did you
say that? Oh, yeah, because I was thinking that, you know, 10 min 10 trips just didn't seem to me to be remotely plausible. Maybe what you meant was the larger number. But, Steve,
let me point out something, Jim.
The point is literally thousands of joints and beams that have to be cut by this. I mean, as an internal, you know, this is very clever, extensive.
Will you let me answer that first question?
Please.
Before you go on. Okay, the point, Jim, is if we can find residue for thermite, we don't have to be specific. It's just like we don't have to say how many men did it, how many trips. That's beyond the point. Why do people get messed up and off on a tangent? Because, Jim, let me answer the darn question.
Being able to specify
the wavelength.
I mean, if they can show you that there's devastation
that
appears inexplicable on any account other than a directed energy weapon, I mean, isn't
that
exactly parallel?
When we find these residues, then we can say we demand an investigation. That's what we're after. We don't have to answer all the questions. Social Security number, the people who went in there, like Wood and Reynolds asked me for. I don't have to answer that. That comes out of the criminal investigation. Surely they must know that when a crime scene investigation is done and with hard physical evidence, like sulfidation and the presence of residues that are indicative of thermite, now we proceed to a criminal investigation, and that's how we answer the questions of how many men and how many trips.
Well, it
for
might
heaven's
be sufficient
sake,
that if some of the building was brought down by thermite, and that evidence is, you know, in the sulfidation,
and that's all we need.
That even
then
if
we've
not
got
all
our
of the building was brought down by thermite. Because, you know, I'm inclined to believe we're talking about multiple modes of causation, and I
still am baffled
as to how, you know, bringing down the Twin Towers with thermite can possibly wreak all that devastation on the rest of the World Trade Center, Steve.
Because
you
all you have
you
to do, I can answer your question if you'll let me answer it.
Please.
All you have to do is establish that a crime was committed. You do that with hard physical evidence. Then you proceed to the trial. We're not playing a game here of how many men and how many trips. We're playing a very serious scientific study to get to an investigation. It's forensics that we're trying to do here. We want an investigation. We want justice. We want to support those families who lost their loved ones in those towers. We do that by establishing that there is clear evidence of a crime. We do that by looking for the residues, and we're finding it. That's the key.
And I couldn't agree with you more that we have been able to disprove the government's account on virtually every significant point that it has made. And anyone who wants to pursue this is welcome to visit 911scholars.org. Just go to Why Doubt 9/11 at the top. Visit the Beginner Start Here section. I just want to emphasize that what Steve and I have been talking about is a far more difficult and challenging task, trying to figure out what actually happened on 9/11 when we know what did not happen. What did not happen is that these buildings were brought down by the combined impact of aircraft crashes, fireballs burning up most of the jet fuel, these very modest jet fuel fires, the weakening or the melting of the steel in a pancake collapse, we're completely in agreement that the government's account is complete and utter intellectual rubbish. And, Steve, for coming on today, I want to thank you so very much.
Okay, Jim.
And I welcome
you.
That
my
we're
pleasure.
Looking at a full range of alternative hypotheses in relation to the complete explanandum. And I just hope that everyone will take a good look at the evidence. Go to 911scholars.org or the alternative site and take a look at, for example, the video there that is a survey of the massive destruction, including the toasted cars, the only partial damage to the bathtub, what seems to be the disappearance of most of the mass of these huge, gigantic buildings, the amount of time in which they came down, the fact that the wrong building fell first because the steel is thinner at the 96th floor than it is at the 80th, the fires burn more intensely and longer in the North Tower than they did in the South, and because a plane hit the middle of the building, it surely had to cut more core columns than would be true in the South Tower, where the plane hit the corner and might have cut as few as one. All those reasons show devastating evidence against the government's official account. We can all join in